On his way out the door, said one Nobel-winning economist, Mnuchin is effectively trying to create a financial crisis. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Andrea Germanus Reiner. This article is published under the heading Bond Stress Behavior. Mnuchin slammed for Biden's snub that could sabotage U.S. economic recovery. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was accused recently of taking exactly the wrong policy move right now and sabotaging the U.S. economy for the incoming U.S. administration after announcing an end-of-year cutoff to several key coronavirus relief lending programs at the Federal Reserve. CNBC's reporting quoted one financial expert who likened the move by Mnuchin to stripping a ship of its lifeboats when they're most needed. The outlet explained, Mnuchin announced recently that he will not extend the Federal Reserve's emergency lending programs that use Congress CARES Act beyond December 31st. The move is expected to drastically reduce the central bank's ability to shore up the financial system. It's hard to find an economic rationale for it, Carl Weinberg, chief economist at High Frequency Economics, told CNBC's Squawk Box Europe recently. I don't think there is a good economic or public health or social reason to explain why they want to cut these programs, he added. So it's kind of got to be politics, doesn't it? At issue are an array of relief loan programs facilitated by the Fed with funds provided by the Treasury that were authorized by U.S. Congress earlier this year. These programs include the Primary Market Corporate Credit Facility, Secondary Market Corporate Credit Facility, Municipal Liquidity Facility, Main Street Lending Program, and Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility. With respect to the facilities that use CARES Act funding, Mnuchin wrote recently to Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, I was personally involved in drafting the relevant part of the legislation and believe the congressional intent, as outlined in Section 4029, was to have the authority to originate new loans or purchase new assets, either directly or indirectly, expire on December 31, 2020. As such, I'm requesting that the Federal Reserve return the unused funds to the Treasury. This will allow Congress to reappropriate $455 billion, consisting of $429 billion in excess Treasury funds for the Federal Reserve facilities and $26 billion in unused Treasury direct loan funds, wrote Mnuchin. Mnuchin's letter, as Bloomberg News reported, elicited swift rebuke from Powell. In a statement released recently minutes after Mnuchin's letter, the Fed urged that the full suite of emergency facilities established during the coronavirus pandemic continue to serve their important role as a backstop for our still strained and vulnerable economy. The central bank, noted Axios, almost never issued public statements. The Trump administration's move sparked a chorus of criticism from economists, including Paul Krugman. In a Friday Twitter thread, Krugman said Mnuchin is effectively trying to create a financial crisis, or at least make one more likely. Krugman added that, basically, we are looking at more sabotage by an administration on its way out. Mnuchin's announcement also drew scathing rebuke from Neil Borofsky, former Inspector General of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, who described the program's move to the chopping block as a reckless political decision and called on the Trump administration not to succumb to the political temptation to straitjacket its successor. In his recent op-ed at New York Times, Borofsky urged Mnuchin to follow the approach of George W. Bush administration's outgoing Treasury Department when it did all that it could to preserve President-elect Barack Obama's discretion to use congressionally approved bailout funds from the Troubled Asset Relief Program to steer nation's recovery. Trump's Treasury Department wrote Borofsky should reserve its reckless course and follow the precedent set with TARP by extending these programs to give the newly elected administration as much flexibility as possible. It makes no sense to celebrate the programs for the success they have had in calming markets, Borofsky added, while at the same time pulling the rug out from under them at a time when they're likely to be most needed.
A successful hit deep inside Saudi Arabia. Yemen's Ansarullah fighters carried out a retaliatory missile strike on an oil facility in the Saudi port city of Jeddah on Monday. The Yemeni army says a new winged missile called the Quds 2 was used in the operation against the distribution station operated by Saudi Aramco. Yemen's military spokesman Yahya Sari said it was another response to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. The military spokesman warned Saudis and foreign companies operating in the kingdom to stay away from vital installations, as he pledged that Yemeni fighters will keep up such retaliatory operations. The new Quds 2 cruise missile must have flown over 400 miles to reach its target. The latest missile strike once again underscores Ansarullah's fast improving capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision.
This strike on Aramco's site should certainly let the Saudi kingdom know that this is not a war it can win. It has attempted for years to defeat the Yemeni people and has not succeeded, and they're only getting stronger.
Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of the kingdom and the architect of the war, has been under pressure to find a way to end the failing, protracted military campaign. None of the strategic goals of the invasion have been fulfilled after all these years. But bin Salman's close ties with the U.S. President Donald Trump, mainly based on huge American arms sales, have allowed him to keep the war going. Will the Saudi prince take the increasing power of Yemeni forces seriously and change direction? The Saudi-led war in Yemen began in March 2015. It will be the sixth anniversary of the war in just a few months. The war in Yemen has been described by many as a forgotten war. The onslaught has been rarely covered by mainstream media. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war got little attention in Western news channels. The situation has long been the world's worst humanitarian disaster. As the Yemenis suffered, the business-minded president of the United States took the opportunity to seal massive arms deals with the Saudis. The kingdom has been free to buy anything from America, from fighter jets to command and control system and advanced battle tanks and warships. The U.S. is a partner in this aggression. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies also includes mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. The incumbent U.S. president will probably leave the White House soon. How will his successor Joe Biden act on Yemen? Saudi Arabia has a very powerful lobby in Washington, and the kingdom's petrodollars have proven irresistible to American politicians and decision makers for many decades.
It's unlikely there'll be any change. The U.S. is always happy to foment and encourage a disruption and disorder and chaos anywhere in the Middle East. And because Saudi Arabia is such a large buyer of U.S. weaponry, the United States government under Biden or Trump or anybody else will not want to see those profits diminish.
Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regime of Saudi Arabia, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
The naval fleet of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently received a new domestically built ocean-going warship capable of carrying aircraft, drones, and missile defense systems. The heavyweight multipurpose vessel, which has been designed for long sea journeys, joined the IRGC's Navy during a ceremony on Thursday. The 4,000-ton warship, which is 150 meters long and 22 meters wide, can carry drones, helicopters, and operational vessels, as well as missile, air defense, and radar systems. It is named Shahid Rudaki Warship after martyred IRGC Navy Commander Abdullah Rudaki. The vessel is equipped with three-dimensional phased array radars, surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles, advanced communication systems for electronic warfare, and a Khordad 3 air defense system, all of which are designed and put into operation by Iranian experts.
The main issue for the armed forces is to be strong enough to defend the country and to retaliate any possible attack against Iran. So that is part of that. And since we have the Persian Gulf and the Caspian Sea in south and north of Iran, it has been very important to have a good and powerful navy.
Rear Admiral Ayreza Tangsiri, commander of Iran's IRGC Navy, said the vessel can carry out combat, logistical, and intelligence-gathering missions in the ocean aimed at establishing stable security in maritime transportation lines and providing assistance to the commercial and fishing fleets belonging to the Islamic Republic and regional countries. U.S. President Donald Trump's new acting defense secretary, Christopher Miller, said last week that Washington will be cutting the number of its deployed troops to Afghanistan and Iraq to 5,000 from 7,500 forces that are currently present there. Just days later, however, the U.S. Central Command said in a statement that two B-52 bombers were deployed to West Asia on short notice to deter what it called potential aggression and reassure U.S. partners and allies in the region. That comes after the New York Times said in a report that Trump had asked his close allies what options were available to take action against Iran's main nuclear site at Natanz. The report adds that the advisors warned the president that a military action could spark a broader conflict in the region.
There have been times that Iran and the United States have been much closer to a war between themselves. So it's not a tough situation right now. It's not the tension is high to some extent, but it's not that high that we would be worried about any possible war. But the United States know that it's not capable of attacking Iran and doing a war, because we have seen for 20 years the situation in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and the United States was not capable of fighting against those countries completely, and we were introduced to endless wars because of those two countries. So let alone the Iran, which is actually much more powerful and much bigger than those countries.
Some experts are now questioning how such an attack would help Donald Trump while the United States is dealing with political uncertainty over who will control the White House for the next 4 years following a contested election. Donald Trump announced the United States' withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran by unilaterally reimposing sanctions on the country. His stance on Iran has been repeatedly criticized internationally, including even by the closest U.S. allies. But Tehran has warned that any aggression by the U.S. against Iran, it Trump's attempt to distract the American public in the aftermath of the November 3rd election, or an excuse to stay in power, will certainly be met with a crushing response.
Russia says the United States has deceived Moscow, and the international community after it conducted an advanced intercontinental missile interception test. Russia's foreign ministry says the exercise used technology that is part of the Aegis Ashore missile defense system, which the Pentagon had assured the Kremlin was not aimed at Russia's long-range capabilities. A Russian foreign ministry spokesperson has described the development as quote-unquote a new confirmation of the dangerous and destabilizing character of Washington's anti-ballistic missile strategy and quote obvious anti-Russian orientation. Maria Zakharova says the test proved the falsity of American statements, saying, quote, for many years, America assured us that the interception of Russian ICBMs by American standard systems, including this modification, is technically impossible. There are fears the test risks paving the way for Russia testing similar technologies against America's intercontinental ballistic missiles. Moscow has already stated that it reserves the right to take the necessary response measure. On Monday, the U.S. military used the new advanced technology to fire, for the first time, a missile from a warship which downed an ICBM. Previously, the U.S. had promoted the weapons system as being limited against short and intermediate-range missile threats. Russia says this is direct evidence and a concrete example of how Washington manipulated public opinion of its country, lied to its international partners, and justified its actions in the international arena with far-fetched pretexts. Following the collapse of the INF and before the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the only remaining U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control agreement, New START, is also, as things stand, set to expire early next year. Moscow says it hasn't closed the door on negotiations to extend the agreement, formerly known as the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. The projected U.S. presidential election winner, Joe Biden, has previously said he will explore the treaty's extension without conditions. However, bilateral relations between the two countries have always been on very shaky grounds. Analysts say the latest American missile test will only escalate military tensions. Amid Russia's worsening relations with NATO, it could not have come at a worse time. Questions have been raised as to whether the U.S. may use the system against Russian military interests. The weapon used to down the ICBM, the Standard Missile 3 or SM-3, is part of the Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense System. Moscow has long suspected the system to be a major pathway to a U.S. global missile shield to undermine Russia's military power. The SM-3 missiles have also been deployed close to Russian soil, in Poland and Romania. Moscow says it has repeatedly warned it would take similar measures to ensure national security and maintain a strategic stability. Essentially, that means more sophisticated weapon systems deployed by the adversaries, while suspicions between the U.S. on the one hand and Russia and China on the other spiral out of control.
Bahrain's top diplomat on an official visit to Israel, breaking a long-time taboo. Foreign Minister Abdel Latif al-Zayani landed in Israel on Wednesday. His controversial trip this week marks the first such visit to Israel by any official from the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Al-Zayani's trip coincides with a visit to Israel by America's top diplomat Mike Pompeo. The Bahraini delegation went on to occupy Jerusalem al-Quds. The top Bahraini diplomat sat down for talks with senior Israeli officials, including his counterpart Gabi Ashkenazi and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. Secretary of State was apparently there to facilitate the controversial rapprochement. Al-Zayani's trip, which has angered the Palestinians, is part of a U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between the two sides.
It is obvious that the Trump administration wants to make sure that the normalization process and the what they used to call the deal of the century will be very crucial and strong before they get away from the power in January. So they are doing marathonian steps so that everything will be on the ground and will be very much clear laid out.
Palestinian groups denounced the trilateral meeting between the U.S., Bahrain and Israel as a clear attack on the rights of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians want all Arab nations to refrain from establishing ties with Israel until the Israeli occupation is over and a Palestinian state becomes a reality. But as part of a U.S. brokered initiative, Bahrain and its Persian Gulf neighbor, the United Arab Emirates, signed normalization accords with Israel at the White House in mid-September. Sudan has also agreed to normalize ties with Israel as part of a deal that will guarantee much-needed U.S. financial aid. Israel has escalated its violations in the occupied territories over the past years. For instance, it has stepped up settlement construction on occupied lands. The regime has also stepped up demolition of Palestinian homes. So far this year, nearly 700 structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The UN says that number is more than the figure in any full year since 2016. Palestinians have widely blamed the worsening situation on policies pursued by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. The American president makes no secret of his extremely pro-Israel stance. Trump took the American support for the region to a whole new level by moves such as recognizing Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital. Palestinian groups now say the U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between several Arab states and Israel is further emboldening the regime. How can Palestinians now trust the U.S. as it loudly brands itself as a mediator between them and Israel? Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say these Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, the people of Palestine are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The article you're about to hear has been authored by Claudia Song and carries the title, Is Trump Trying to Take the Economy Down with Him? Stay with us for more on this topic. Consumed by Election Day, the U.S. Congress effectively abandoned the country when it failed to reach an agreement in October on a desperately needed relief bill. Now, its energy is geared toward the partisan mess of the presidential transition and two Senate runoffs in Georgia. The result has been that the stability in the markets, as well as recovery in the broader economy and state and local governments, is largely resting with the Federal Reserve, specifically its use of emergency lending tools in partnership with the Treasury to buy trillions in corporate bonds, to make crisis loans to medium-sized businesses, and to municipalities looking to plug some extreme budget shortfalls. These emergency facilities, as they're called, when they are authorized by CARES Act in the spring and set to expire next month, played a major role in staving off free fall in the credit markets. Recently, U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin sent a shocking letter to Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, announcing that he was not going to extend the emergency programs for municipalities and medium-sized businesses, a retreat which could be disastrous for major sectors of the U.S. economy, even if the stock markets focus on positive vaccine news. Mr. Mnuchin misleadingly spoke on CNBC as if he were simply following the intent of the law by yanking this monetary aid away, and he put the onus on Congress to reappropriate these funds, even though widespread reporting suggests his boss, President Trump, has no interest in new deals. Tellingly, a couple of programs that helped Wall Street were allowed to live on in an abundance of cushion, as the secretary's letter claimed. The Federal Reserve would prefer that the full suite of emergency facilities established during the coronavirus pandemic continue to serve their important role as a backstop for the still strained and vulnerable economy, the central bank said in a statement recently. Secretary Mnuchin's move comes just as Joe Biden is preparing to name his own Treasury Secretary, and it fits a growing pattern of Trump's team doing everything it can to undermine and kneecap the incoming administration's ability to crisis to manage. For those wondering how an alphabet soup of emergency financial measures that can be turned off by a lame duck cabinet member whim came to be so important, no, it's not supposed to work this way. On paper, U.S. Congress should have seen that the ongoing crisis, including the roughly 1 million teachers and many other public workers in education who have been laid off because state and local budgets are in shambles, was getting worse, and that it required them to pass renewed direct fiscal aid. That, of course, hasn't happened. Still, there was hope that the Fed could make up for it by being even more aggressive about its ability to issue low-cost loans, using ample CARES Act funds and its own statutory powers. Instead, while the Fed's emergency loan programs to backstop the financial markets have been widely seen as a general success, the loan program it set up for state and local governments, the municipal liquidity facility was disappointing. Because the Fed's municipal loan terms are so tough, there were few takers. Only 2 loans have been made, one to the state of Illinois and another to the Metropolitan Transportation Authority of New York, for a total of $1.7 billion, which is 0.3% of the $500 billion Congress authorized for facilitating such loans in the CARES Act. And for the MTA, those loans remain inadequate, as New York City still plans to lay off subway workers and drastically cut service. Mr. Powell has often sounded exasperated when expressed about the program this fall. He explains that private actors in the municipal bond markets are there to make the vast majority of loans, so we, the Fed, only actually have to do a backstop, which stabilizes the private rates being offered. Then he sidesteps follow-ups like those from Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, which argue that those private loan terms are still seen as onerous by state and local leaders from Louisiana to California. If still pressed, he repeats over and over the limits of the Fed's authority to make emergency loans. This most recent news that Secretary Mnuchin has not only been tamping down any consideration of the Fed using the emergency program more boldly, but now also plans to shut it down, has shown that Chairman Powell has a point. If you get into the weeds of the CARES Act, you will see that Congress instructed the Fed to work with the Treasury on the details of the emergency lending facilities, and that the Treasury has the ultimate say.
Inside Israel.
While economic and health experts in Israel weigh in daily on how to save the Israelis medically and financially, there is little talk regarding a consequence of the virus that could cause the most damage: mental health. Over 1.2 million Israeli adults reported deterioration in mental and emotional state, but that figure was for the first lockdown. Now, researchers report a 40% increase in that number for a total of 1,680,000.
The first is social distancing and the quarantine. Many people are alone now, and alone for long periods of time and isolated. Depression and anxiety, we've been seeing a lot of these people getting worse, and also people without pre-existing issues. It's just a problem.
The issue of mental disorders in Israel is not new. Unfortunately, it was never properly addressed by authorities, as no funds were allocated to it. And now, with the current political chaos and budget deadlock, it seems highly unlikely that the regime would pay attention to this problem.
People are out of jobs, people don't have enough money.
Even in the military, Israelis who are drafted there fake mental health disorders just to go AWOL from the military. We are talking about one-third of the Israeli males and 44% of females avoid being drafted into the military for mental health reasons. Mati Kasbi, one of Israel's leading musicians, posted a message on his Facebook page announcing that he and his family were leaving Israel in order to protect their mental health. He blames the Israeli regime for what he called the sad situation the regime creates for its citizens and culture. Mental health experts are warning of another epidemic in Israel. They say that the emotional and psychological impact of the coronavirus pandemic are no less severe than the havoc wreaked on Israel's health system and the economy. Psychologist Eled Mardo of Haifa University, who is behind the study, reports a 300% increase in requests for psychological treatment. The data shows that 25% of Israelis over the age of 21, that is approximately 1.2 million people, report a deterioration in their mental and emotional state after the first lockdown. This, while 26% say the emotional state of their children has taken a turn for the worse. According to the professor behind the study, these are catastrophic numbers. The issue of mental health in Israel is not new. It has always been a social issue that the regime never really found a cure for. Israelis do not seek help because there are few problems. Many people do not seek out mental health services. Mental health services cost money, and as people feel the extended economic strain, mental health support is often viewed as non-essential. About 87% of Israelis with mental health issues stated that they simply could not afford to seek help for their mental health, according to a report published by the American Psychological Association. due to almost non-existent programs amidst the political chaos and budget deadlock, there is no support for the unemployed to relieve the most severe economic distress. Steps to address the mental health issues in Israel are not being taken so correctly. Researchers point out to the lack of educational campaigns among Israelis regarding identification of mental health problems and appropriate use of mental health services offered by the health plans. Israelis are unaware of what is available.
First of all, a lot of doctors that could provide some kind of assistance or first diagnosis, family doctors, general physicians, were not available at that time. And for a while, you couldn't reach the mental health clinics. And there was a big confusion at the beginning why you couldn't reach psychologists and mental health workers. That was one source. People were locked down at home. And that caused both social isolation and a lot of anxiety among people. People didn't know what was going on. In addition, bear in mind that people were detached from and disconnected from their communities, from their schools, from their everyday life. And all that caused a lot of stress and a lot of times depression as well. So that could explain some rise in mental health states. At the beginning, we saw the Prime Minister showing up in himself, in person, showing up in prime time and addressing the nation. But the way he addressed it, I believe, caused more panic. He wanted to make sure that people take care of themselves, maintain social distance, maintain hygiene, wear masks, although at the beginning people say it's not helpful at all, and then suddenly it became helpful. As time went by, people expressed more anxiety, I believe, due to those conferences, the daily conferences. You felt that things are changing constantly, that the decision makers often are not sure about how to handle this issue. They were learning the issue themselves. And the issue of mental health was not addressed at all. It was not an issue at all. People were worried about physical health and breaking the chains of contagion. And so the issue of mental health was not addressed at all. You know, and we had some leaders saying also, you know, that just go out and have fun. Don't worry about it. This issue was not considered at all until it was a huge pressure from public services, psychological public services, that started stressing that the issue of mental health and mental wellness will be addressed as well. This issue was not handled at all.
On social media, here's what users said. Norian said, little is known about the Israeli Jews suffering in Israel under their right-wing regime, children being taken from parents. An estimated 200 fathers a year have killed themselves. I heard this in a podcast from an Israeli activist. There is much poverty. All people deserve humanity. Yossi Bernstein says, she bets more women will suffer from domestic violence than the virus. Priya says, world's first psychiatric corona ward has opened in Israel. I had predicted this would happen. Corona will eventually go away, but people need to keep their minds sane. It's a mental challenge for the world.
There is great political instability in Israel right now. And the coronavirus is being used as a political tool, for instance, to shut down demonstrations in front of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's home. The politicization of this COVID crisis is causing great anxiety among Israeli people, and Israeli people have good cause to question the actions of their government, even the legitimacy of their government.
The issue of mental disorders is prevalent in the Israeli military as well. In fact, 1/3 of the Israeli males and 44% of females avoid being drafted into the military for mental health reasons. To avoid the mandatory service, Israelis rely on a military law that allows recruits to receive an exemption on grounds of medical or health issues. According to Israeli law, any individual whose health standards is less than 21 points is exempted from the military service. Some pretend to be suffering from poor mental health or disability to score low grades, an act seen as extremely dangerous by Israeli authorities. The mental health crisis in Israel is impacting all sectors and parts of Israeli society. An Israeli crisis hotline says it is receiving an unprecedented level of suicidal calls, and many of them are from people who did not have any previous diagnosed mental health issues before the pandemic started. According to the nonprofit organization that is supported by the health ministry, Iran, since the onset of the coronavirus crisis, some 5,500 Israelis who are considering ending their lives have made contact. According to Iran, it took 240,000 emergency calls since the pandemic started. About 60% of these calls are about dealing with daily challenges, financial and employment problems, mental health, and identity crises. The organization stated that 86% of inquiries come from people in crisis, or what it called emotional overload. So far, according to the organization, there is no end to these numbers in sight.
Well, in recent years, we've seen reports that there is an increase in Israeli youngsters trying to avoid drafting by reporting all kinds of mental health and other issues. About half of them, about 44% of them, were ultra-Orthodox, what we call Haredim, pretty much the same number, about 46%, were secular. In some groups in Israeli society, it became unfashionable to go to the military. I don't think it's necessarily a result of mental health problems among young people, partly, which I'll discuss in a minute, but also that it became not such a problem, not such a stigma in Israel, not serving in the army, because it just doesn't fit me anymore and I'm not too crazy about military service and it'll take 2 or 3 years of my life. I believe that having policies that change constantly, that are clearly affected by political issues, and decisions are not based on professional expert opinions, are very difficult to digest and to be accepted. When you see that the entire country is in lockdown, while actually only certain cities are red cities because of a high percentage of sick people, but the entire country goes into lockdown because certain groups oppose closing down just those cities, you understand that there's little professional advice involved in this issue. And therefore, the trust in one's government, in policymakers, in decision makers, in high-ranking officials has deteriorated dramatically. And therefore, you don't know whom to believe. When different ministries are fighting with each other, Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education, Ministry of Treasure.
On social media, here's what users said. Medusa is done, says she's sick of war and the endless glorification of war and military violence. In Israel, so many kids are gung-ho about going into combat units and end up with PTSD and massive mental health issues for the rest of their lives. But no one talks about that. Marwa says, how about Israel pays reparations for the mental health of Lebanese who endured its terrorism and still do down south? Jonathan says, if Israel cared about the mental health of its soldiers, it would stop making them be an occupying force that denies the humanity of other people.
Some people don't agree with the service in the army, but it's a tiny, tiny minority. There is a minority of people who do not want to serve in the army for religious reasons. But there is a small, tiny minority of people who feel that they cannot serve in the Israeli army for various reasons. Some of them might be political, but it's a tiny minority. You have to understand that the people usually serve in the Israeli army willingly and not so much under duress. However, there is a small minority, a very small number, less than 1% or even less than that, who might opt for a release from the army under some kind of mental health suggestion. But this is a tiny, tiny group of people.
Researchers warn that the problem of mental health will persist with or without coronavirus because of the lack of innovative interventions. People, according to experts, need to receive appropriate mental health services, but it is almost impossible due to the limitations related to the economic, social, and technological barriers. The health ministry and the regime are not reaching out by the technology available to Israelis for their mental health care. Given Israel's multi-ethnic society, information is not communicated in a linguistically and culturally appropriate manner, researchers found. This means that the regime and bureaucracy are not using the language used by many Israelis to communicate with them. It only uses the official Hebrew language. Also, religious leaders and organizations play a prominent role in Israeli society and serve as trusted sources of mental health information and referrals. Technically, there are no too limited efforts being made to facilitate the religious and mental health care sectors working more closely together. This leaves the average Israeli citizen with mental health problems wondering how they can seek help in a helpless society. Here's the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. The health ministry reported that 4,036 Israelis passed away during September, a rise of 18.6% compared to the same period in 2019, even though Israel's population only grew by 2%. The ministry also said that 642 people succumbed to coronavirus in September, accounting for 1 in 6 of all fatalities that month. The Times of Israel, an Israeli study that researched people's financial responses to the direct one-time coronavirus stimulus payments distributed by the regime in August, found that more people used their fiscal stimulus checks to pay outstanding debts rather than going out and spending. The study found that among respondents to the survey, the main use of the grants, 42%, was paying down outstanding debt. Just a little over a fourth, 26%, reported they increased their spending after receiving the grant, and 15% said they save the money. I-24 News. Israel insists what had caused a power outage in many areas across Israel was not caused by a cyber attack. In a statement released by Israel Electric Corporation, it was stressed that the private power station in Be'er Tuvia stopped working, which led to a chain reaction in other surrounding stations. The Jerusalem Post. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his life is threatened on a daily basis, but the threats are not being taken seriously. When opposition members took offense at Netanyahu for equating threats against him with Rabin's assassination by a right-wing extremist, he said he could give examples. He also accused the press then and now of being monolithic and presenting only one side, and warned against silencing political rivals.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The world body has to stop releasing statement after statement condemning the Zionist regime and its apartheid policies, and instead take decisive actions to hold the usurper regime and its Western supporters to account. This has to include an international legal push and resolution that forces the Israeli regime and its Western allies to end the occupation of Palestine and allow people there, including Jews, Christians, and Muslims, decide their future government through a national referendum. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the Safa Fars News Agency published under the heading, Is UN Condemnation Enough for Zionist Regime? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Once again, the United Nations has expressed concerns for the Zionist regime of Israel's decision to advance construction in an illegal Jewish settlement in occupied East Al-Quds that would make establishing a contiguous Palestinian state even harder, reiterating that settlement construction is illegal under international law. Nikolai Mladenov, the UN envoy to the West Asia region peace process, says, if built, it would further consolidate a ring of settlements between Al-Quds and Beit Lahm in occupied West Bank. It would significantly damage prospects for a future contiguous Palestinian state and for achieving a negotiated two-state solution based on 1967 lines with Al-Quds as the capital of both states. Settlement construction is illegal under international law, and I call on the authorities to reverse this step, he added. Another instance and proof that a Palestinian approach based on compromise for the sake of a two-state solution never works, and yet another piece of evidence to prove that the Palestinian Authority and Fatah movement's recent shift to join the resistance movements of Hamas and Islamic Jihad has been an appropriate move and a correct policy. the Palestinian Authority and the European Union's foreign policy chief have also criticized the Israeli regime's move. The PA sought a future independent state that includes East Al-Quds and the West Bank, territories occupied by the Zionist regime in 1967 war, and viewed the settlements as a major obstacle to peace. With nearly 500,000 illegal settlers now living in the West Bank and more than 220,000 in the occupied East Al-Quds, the PA has now come to realize that the chances of establishing their state have evaporated, meaning that the precious time they have wasted on the negotiating table with the Zionists has only served the Israelis to encroach forward without even a war with the PA. Much of Al-Quds is already blocked off from the West Bank by a series of checkpoints and a separation barrier built by the Zionist regime. In other words, UN condemnation is not enough to stop the usurper regime from building more illegal settlements on Palestinian lands. The same argument could be made about the UN condemnation of the Israeli blockade on Gaza. Just because the world body also condemns the criminal siege, it doesn't mean that the Israeli regime would now lift the blockade and allow the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees in the Near East run schools and provide health services as well as other humanitarian aid to the Strip and an estimated 5.7 million Palestinians with refugee status. Gaza, with a population of 2 million, has been under a hermetic Israeli siege since 2006, when the Palestinian group Hamas won the democratic legislative elections in occupied Palestine. Since then, the Zionist regime of Israel has carried out numerous bombing campaigns and several major wars that resulted in the death of thousands of people. This only makes the UN's work ever more difficult. The world body has to stop releasing statement after statement condemning the Zionist regime of Israel and its apartheid policies, and instead take decisive actions to hold the usurper regime and its Western supporters to account. This has to include an international legal push and resolution that forces the Israeli regime and its Western allies to end the occupation of Palestine and allow people there, including Jews, Christians, and Muslims, decide their future government through a national referendum. An international push as such should hold the fake Israeli regime accountable for fundamental violations of international law during decades of occupation and terror, which is the longest-lasting military occupation in the modern world and shows no signs of ending. The criminal regime has crossed many red lines into illegality, and this has paved the way for international legal processes to be triggered and the occupation to be ended. As per international law, the laws of occupation are very clear that the Israeli regime cannot treat the territory as its own, nor can it make claims of sovereignty. Yet, this has been its pattern of governing the occupied Palestinian territory for most of its 72 years of reign of terror. The Zionist regime has also been in non-compliance with more than 40 resolutions of the UN Security Council and with more than 100 resolutions of the General Assembly, thanks largely to the diplomatic support by the United States of America and its duped Arab allies in the West Asia region. These anti-Palestine regimes are the reasons why Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu keeps telling the international civil society that Al-Quds will be part of the Israeli regime forever, no more Jewish settlements will be uprooted, and the Israeli regime will stay permanently in the Jordan Valley in any peace agreement. Indeed, the time has come for the UN and the rest of civil society to compel